Part 2. The Veiled City. Can you imagine what it means to be blind? Truly blind. Not the simple removal of the visual sense or the temporary darkness of night, but utterly bereft of sensation. That is what they think they have done to me by severing my connection to the great ocean. But such a concept displays a literalness of thought that betrays ignorance of the warp's true nature. It is all around me, no matter what my jailers believe, but it pleases me to let them think they have wounded me with their damping collars and walls impregnated with psi-resistant crystals. I felt the cataclysmic arrival of my gene father in the depths of the palace, and I still feel the havoc that resonates around the globe in its aftermath. I touched the mind of the Crimson King, and I saw a measure of what drove him to such desperate action. Though I am Athenaean, the foresight of the Corvidae and the vanity of the Pavoni are not unknown to me, nor are the visceral arts of the Raptora or the Pyrrhae beyond my reach, though it irritates me to wield such vulgar powers. An adept exemptus of the Thousand Suns is master of many things, and is a more terrible foe than anyone here understands. But it is well to keep your foes ignorant of your true strength. All war is deception, and wars are won by those who can best conceal their blows. I can hear the thoughts of my caged brothers, the controlled anger of Asuber, and the febrile rages of his twin. The dour gloom of Githua is amusing in small doses, as are the petulant diatribes Argentus Chiron composes. No one who matters will hear them, but his desire to perfect his outrage knows no bounds. All of them rage at the injustice done to us, not one of them understanding that it could be no other way. Tagore still broods on the insultingly small force sent to apprehend us, but his rage is spread thin at our captors for coming for us in the first place, at the men who killed his fellow warriors, at his legion for abandoning him. But most of all, it is directed at me for not warning them. How can I begin to explain my reasoning to him when I do not understand it myself? It was not the words of the Psi Hunter that persuaded me to stand aside. His words were as meaningless as the random mind noise of warp scraps. Rather, it was the dream that stayed my hand, the dream of the icy blue-lit tomb that gave me pause. In my dream, I walk its frozen catacombs, and I see that the ground is littered with shards of glassy bone. Millions carpet the flagstones, pouring from the broken sepulchres in an endless tide. I see each individual fragment, each one reflective and carrying a memory etched on its vitrified surface. A great red eye reflected in broken shards of bone. I know this eye. I know it well, and it is speaking to me of a terrible crime, though I do not yet understand what it is saying. It is a bleak place, this tomb, where I wander in the bleak light of torches frozen in time, their flames unmoving and lifeless. The dead are all around me. I can feel them looking at me. The weight of their accusations is like a curse, to use a pejorative of the ancients. Though this is a city of death, it is frighteningly beautiful, rearing statues of hooded reapers and spiteful angels adorn the grand avenues of the dead, their expressions frozen at their most tempestuous. Something flits past at the edge of my vision, something vividly coloured in this landscape of the morbid. It darts between the towering monolithic statuary, a scavenger creature that could not possibly be here. I recognize its tapered snout and rust-colored fur, the black edging to its ears and feet. Canis lupus, a species extinct for thousands of years, yet here it is. I am no biologist, but somehow I know this creature will not die here. The wolf shadows my path through the blizzard of bone, drawing closer with every passing moment, though I wave my arms and shout bloody threats at it. Seeing that the wolf will not be dissuaded from its approach, I ignore its presence and concentrate on where my steps carry me. Towards a monstrous statue, one that was not there a moment ago, but which rears from the landscape like a vast missile emerging from a silo. It is the winged statue of a faceless angel, fashioned from a strange twilight black stone. Bone dust falls from its wide shoulders, and avalanches big enough to bury one of the Terran hives thunder past. Like any initiate of the word of Magnus, I understand the symbolism of powerful elemental forces, and know full well the times of upheaval they herald. I sense something within this statue, something malevolent watching through its smooth, featureless face. As I am aware of its presence, it too is aware of me. The sky above this newly emerged statue gleams with dull metal and golden spires. A starship hangs motionless above this mausoleum city. Its pristine blue paint has been burned away, and only the pearlescent stubs of its master's insignia remain to indicate that it was once a vessel of the 13th Legion. The ship's name is etched into its hull in letters hundreds of meters high, the curling script hammered onto its adamantium hull in the shipyards of Kalth. The Argo. I know this vessel. It is a ghost ship, gutted from within by nightmarish creatures of sublime horror. Red-scaled skin, oily black tongues, and eyes that reflect every vile thought you ever had. Everyone on that vessel is dead, and their deaths weigh heavily on the conscience of one who draws ever nearer. He believes it is his fault. I know this with a certainty that is as unshakable as it is ludicrous. What could he possibly have done to condemn that incredible vessel to such a violent death? Yet certainty is foolish in a place like this, a place where truth and lies can cross the vast gulfs of space in an instant. I deal in the intangible, the allegorical and the phantasmal, yet I assert certitude. The irony is not lost on me. Only then do I realize I am not alone. There are others with me. I recognize them, and I see that they are all dead, ghosts yet to be. They lament their passing and try to tell me of the manner of their deaths, but their words are nonsensical, and I cannot understand them. By their own choosing, each one of them is outcast and dead. Each one has been slain for reasons only he can know, be it honor, pride, vanity, or a hunger for knowledge. Noble reasons all. I listen to their doomed mantras, and I sing them lustily to the shining beacon of light that reaches out to the farthest extent of the galaxy. The one the eye has spoken of is here. Chapter 10. Beneath the peak known as Rakaposhi, the Legio Custodes kept their jail, where those individuals deemed hostile to the Emperor were isolated from the world above. Dug into the rock of the mountain, its limestone walls were clad in adamantium plate, resistant to virtually all forms of weaponry, and deaf to the pleas of innocence that echoed from its cells. In an ancient, long-dead tongue, it had been known as Kangba Mawu, an all-too-literal name that gave some clue to its age. Only the most senior custodians bothered to use its original name, and to those condemned to its cells, never again to see the light of day, It had an altogether more prosaic name. They knew it simply as the Vault. Kangbamawu had always been part of the mountain, or at least so it seemed to those who even knew of it. It had always been a site of incarceration, a hidden place to cage the most violent, the most dangerous, and the most reprehensible evils the world had known. No one knew who had first hacked its cells and passageways from the bedrock of the mountain, but its origins went far beyond the limits of memory and surviving documentation. Stories of the heinous criminals incarcerated in its lightless depths stretched back thousands of years, their names now meaningless and their crimes long forgotten. Yet there were villains aplenty, plucked from living memory, who had darkened its sterile corridors and died insane within its unfeeling walls. The lieutenants of the Pan-Pacific Tyrant had been brought here, as had the ethnarch of the Caucasus Wastes, the so-called First Emperor, and a being known only as the Reaper, a monster that legend said was an angel sent to cleanse mankind from the world. William the Red, the tyrannical blood-drinking prince of Albion, had been brought here for execution after his defeat at the Battle of the Blue Dawn. William's debased followers conquered a quarter of the globe, but were finally halted by an army of powerful warriors raised by a Nordafrik warlord known as Kibuka, who was said to have called lightning from the clouds and granted his warriors superhuman strength. In time, Kibuka himself was hauled in chains to Kangbamawu, but no history remained to tell of who had overturned his rule. A persistent rumour told that the Emperor himself had designed a cell especially for Narth and Duma, but which had gone unused following the tyrant's death during the final battle to bring down his inhuman regime. Scurrilous whispers maintained it had been the urging of Constantine Valdor that saw Duma executed in the ruins of his empire, a half-mad, half-genius psychopath deemed too dangerous to live. Cardinal Tang had been bound for this specialized jail, but like Duma, he never saw the inside of his cell. Inmates who had suffered the worst tortures imaginable in his bloody pogroms broke open his isolation tank and tore his body apart with their bare hands before his transit from Nusir Kambakan could be arranged. In all its long history, only one individual had ever escaped Kangbamawu, a congenital dwarf named Zamora, who was said to have once attained the rank of major in the Proto-Legio Custodes, a fact that made the stories of his escape all the more ridiculous. Since the beginning of the Great Crusade, Kangbamawu had seen no shortage of inmates, deluded fools and doomsayers who raved and ranted of the Emperor's folly or greedy opportunists who sought to exploit this new golden age for their own benefit. None of those incarcerated could boast a pedigree as infamous as Tang or Duma or William. But that would all change once this rebellion was put down. Kangbamawu's most impregnable cell block was even now being made ready to contain the most dangerous individual in the galaxy. But could any facility on Terra hope to hold Horus Lupercal prisoner? Primus Block Alpha 10 was never dark. The diurnal phases of the planet above were inconsequential to the workings of the Vault or the needs of its inmates. Darkness was an aid to escape and was thus banished. Utam Luna Hesh Uda halted before the last security checkpoint before the cells, allowing the biometric surveyors in the walls, floor, and ceiling to verify his identity. Air samplers tasted his breath, body mass sensors registered his weight, and radiation detectors measured the decay rate of isotopes in his blood and bones. Over 100 such measurements and genetic markers were compared against real-time data logs to ensure no intruders were able to penetrate Kangbamawu's security net without detection. Utum wore the gold armor of a custodian, the cheek plates of his full-face helm folded back into its layered structure. His features were unmoving and expressionless, the result of a green-skin bacteriological pathogen that had left the upper right quadrant of his face unresponsive to muscle stimulus. His enhanced metabolism had easily purged the toxin, but the after-effects of the injury had reduced his reflexive response times to a level below the minimum required for frontline service. A proud man, Utam had taken his removal from the fighting ranks of the Legio Custodes hard, but he had adapted and taken to his new role as jailer of the vaults with the same determination and attention to detail that had seen him closest to full infiltration in a blood game until Amon Tauromachian Leng's most recent attempt. Utam had studied the young custodian's route to the palace, finding no fault with any of his decisions until the final moment, when he had chose to throw caution to the wind and leap to the attack like a common assassin. Utam would have drawn his victim in, like a struggling insect in an arachnid's web. Far better to let the prey do the work and subtly carve it from its protectors. Utam stared into the blank slate above the armoured doorway, letting the retinal signifiers examine his eyes. This part always took longer than usual, his damaged eye making the machines work hard to establish his identity. This deep in the vault, such measures were virtually unnecessary, but protocol was protocol, and Utam never willingly ignored protocol. The thought made Utam turn to glance at the procession of veteran soldiers following him. Chosen from the most professional regiments based on Terra, they were armed with a collection of strange weapons, ranging from web guns, plasma nets, isocapacitors and mass crushers, to more commonplace melter guns and hell guns. A full head and shoulders over even the tallest soldier, Utam could barely contain his disdain as they filed past the signifiers. It sat ill with him that these men were not custodians, for the threat rating of the prisoners kept in Primus Block Alpha-10 was far too lethal for these men to face, regardless of what weaponry they carried. Significant levels of the Legio's operational strength had been dispatched on a mission to Prospero alongside the Space Wolves. The purpose of the mission had not been stated, but there could be only one reason to send so many of the Emperor's Praetorians from his side at such a time. Two soldiers in crimson battleplate and gold-mirrored visors guided a metallic box shaped like an oversized coffin floating on repulsor fields. A standard nutrition dispenser, it had been modified by the Vault's Mechanicum staff to provide the specialized foodstuffs of these prisoners. Utam found it incomprehensible that these men had been allowed to live. They were the most dangerous men on Terra, and no good could come of their continued existence. The signifiers confirmed the identity of the last of the soldiers, and the armoured door slid upwards with a hiss of pneumatics and a gust of cool air that spoke of a vast open space ahead. Beyond the door, the iron-sheathed walls of the prison complex gave way to the rough-cut stone of the mountain's footings. The smell of cold earth and stone that had once rested beneath the deepest ocean blew from within. Glaringly bright lumen globes provided stark illumination and banished shadows. 30 meters in, a pair of servitor crewed turrets spooled up and snapped towards them, clicking and whirring as target locks were established. Heavy caliber autocannons whined with the rotational speed of their barrels as Utam stepped into the killing box. "Utam Luna Hesh Udar," he said, enunciating each syllable with precise modulation. The augmented eyes of the servitors changed from red to green, and Utam ushered the soldiers through as his rearguard warrior approached. Sumant Giri Falguni Tirtha was a veteran custodian, whose name was said to bear at least 76 awarded titles. His armour was polished and carved with words of approbation in addition to his earned honours. Utam did not know how Tirtha had come to Kangbar Mawu. He bore no obvious injury and was in prime physical condition, but rumour said he had once questioned an order from Constantin Valdor. The master of the Legio Custodes was a stern, uncompromising man, and though Utam had never had the honour of meeting him, he doubted Valdor was so petty as to banish another from his side for so slight an offence. The Legio valued thinking warriors, doggedly determined men who would question and question again until an answer was forthcoming.
"Is there a problem, Utam?"
asked Tertha.
"Why do you pause?"
"No reason,"
said Utam, ashamed of his lapse into speculation.
"Then let us be on our way," said Tertha. "I dislike being here. The air stinks of them."
Utam nodded. The air did taste different. The unique physiology of the prisoners made them different from mortals, even custodians, in many obvious ways, but also in many less evident ones. Whatever crimes a man might have committed, he was still recognisably human, still clearly part of the human race. These prisoners smelled subtly different, almost alien, and that rankled almost as much than their betrayal. Almost.
"Biometrics confirmed,"
said Utam, and the security door slid closed behind Tertha. As the meter's thick locking bars slid home, he said,
"Primus block Alpha-10 is now sealed and secure."
"So confirmed,"
said Tertha, striding to the front of the column. Utam now took up the rearmost position and took short steps as Tertha led them down the wide corridor. Though they were selected from the bravest and most professional regiments still based on Terra, there was no disguising the soldiers' nervousness as they passed between the turrets. Though rigorous safeties had been engaged by Utam's command, their guns could open fire in a heartbeat, and the green eye lenses of the servitors promised no mercy to anyone caught in the killing box. Utam followed Tertha and the soldiers towards a wide archway, lined with lasmesh emitters, through which came the bass note of colossal generators and the actinic tang of powerful energy fields. Utam passed beneath the arch, emerging into an enormous cavern, a kilometre wide at its narrowest point, with glistening walls and a dizzyingly high roof. The cavern had no floor, simply a bottomless pit that spanned its entire width. Utam knew that such a term was hyperbole of the worst kind, but it was apt for all intents and purposes. He stood on a wide platform built at the edge of the cavern, in the shadow of a slender bridge of lattice steel that reared up like the body of an enormous crane. Tertha stood at its control console, and Utam watched as he manoeuvred the bridge towards an island of rock that floated in the centre of the cavern, suspended on a hazy cushion of invisible energy. Enormous machines, like vast engines, were bolted around the circumference of the cavern walls, and Utam felt the hairs on the back of his neck stand to attention in the electrostatically charged air. At a moment's notice, these generators could be disengaged, and the island would be allowed to plummet into the depths of the world. With such dangerous prisoners, no chances could be taken. The bridge made contact with the floating island, and a host of automated gun pods mounted in the walls of the cavern swung long barrels to bear on the island. 30 isolated cells stood on the floating rock, but only 12 housed inmates. With the bridge in place, Utam marched onto the bridge, with the soldiers and Tertha following behind him. The bridge rang with the sound of his armoured boots, and he kept his gaze focused firmly ahead of him. He unlimbered his guardian spear from the quick-release sheath on his back and rolled the muscles in his shoulder to loosen them in readiness.
"Expecting trouble?"
asked Tertha over the helmet vox.
"No," replied Utam, "but I always feel better facing these bastards with a weapon in my hands."
"I know what you mean," said Tertha.
"I almost hope one of them tries something."
"Don't even joke about it,"
warned Utam as he reached the end of the bridge. The first cell was a square block of triple-layered and ceramite-laced permacrete that gave little clue to the nature of the inmate within. Featureless, aside from an alphanumeric designation stenciled on its side and a transparent door of armour glass normally found in the viewports of starships,
It was a box that no one entered or exited without the say-so of the Legio Custodes. Utam approached the door, feeling a familiar knot of tension in his gut, the flush of endorphins and battle stims that preceded a combat engagement. The sensation was welcome, even though he did not expect a fight here. A single figure sat cross-legged in the centre of the cell, his muscular physique barely contained by the bright yellow of his prison-issue body glove. Long hair, dark as oil, spilled around a broad face with genetically spread features that should be ugly, but somehow combined in a handsome whole. Though this prisoner was deadly beyond words, he had a smooth grace that was disarming. Utam knew better than to underestimate Hathava, simply because he came from a legion of scholars. Where the others raged or spat biliously at their jailers, Hathava appeared to accept his incarceration without rancour. Hathava opened his eyes, one a glittering sapphire, the other a pale amber.
"Utam Luna Heshudar," said the warrior.
"You are interrupting my ascent into the enumerations." "It is time for you to eat," said Utam, as the nutrition dispenser was slotted home in the clear glass of the door. A cellulose bag of foodstuff dropped into the cell, and Hathava watched it fall with a mixture of distaste and resignation.
"Another day, another banquet," said the Thousand Suns warrior.
"You are lucky we feed you at all," said Utam. "I would let you starve."
"Then you would become the villain of the piece," said Hathava. "And as the Emperor's Praetorians, that must never be the case. Is that not so?"
"Do not say his name. You are not fit to speak it, traitor."
"Tell me, Utam, whom had I betrayed when I was brought here?" said Hathava, uncoiling from his seated position to stand in one smooth movement. "When Yasu Nagasena led his 3,000 into the preceptory, who exactly had I betrayed?" "No one.
Yet here I am, locked up in a cell with warriors whose legions are rightly named Oathbreakers." "When a group has a plague carrier in its midst, do you only remove those who are sick, or do you quarantine the entire group?" asked Utam.
"Allow me to counter your example," said Hathava.
"If a man develops a tumour, do you selectively destroy it with treatment, or do you simply kill the man?" "The tumour dies either way."
"Then let us be thankful you are not a medike, Praetorian Utam Luna Heshudar," said Hathava.
They came back to him in the darkness, every face, every scream, and every last terrified breath. Kai lay on a hard stone bench that doubled for a bed and curled in a fetal ball, rocking back and forth as he tried to forget the memories of pain they forced him to relive. A flyer had carried him from the Whispering Tower high into the mountains, through starlit cloudbanks and moon-painted peaks of dizzying height. That had been his ascent. Then had come the descent into the lightless depths of a mountain that seemed somehow darker, somehow more threatening than any mountain had a right to be, as though it carried a weight of anguish borne by those taken into its depths. Down corridors and through echoing passageways he was taken, into rumbling elevators and pneumocars that carried him deeper and deeper into the unknown reaches of the sullen mountain, until at last he was deposited in a bare cell, cut directly from the rock, with only the most basic human functions catered for. A rusted pipe in the corner of the room dribbled brackish water, and a circular pit in the opposite corner appeared to be a receptacle for bodily waste. The walls were painted a faint bluish grey, glossy and hard-wearing. Previous occupants had scraped their presence into the walls with broken nails and whatever else could make an impression in the paint. Primitive, primal things Kai couldn't make out what many of them were, random collections of lightning bolts and men with long spears for the most part. The carvings were little more than desperate pleas to be remembered by men now long forgotten, and presumably long dead. Kai wanted to add his own mark, but he had nothing with which to score the painted walls. His captors had left him to sweat for an unknown period of time, letting the imagined horrors to be inflicted upon him do their work for them. Kai was not a brave man, and he had screamed that he would tell them what they wanted to know if he only knew what it was. Though his mind was racing in a dozen different directions, Kai forced himself to sleep, knowing that whatever was to come would be more easily endured where he rested. He dreamed, but not of the Rub al-Khali, not of the great fortress of Arzashkun, but of a cold void, populated by the voices of the dead. He saw a blonde-haired girl with a blue bandana he had known on the Argo. He knew her name. They had been friends of a sort. But his memory was hazy, too overwhelmed with the chattering voices of the dead. They swarmed his dream self, begging to know why he had been spared and they had been taken, why the monsters of the deep had come for them with their brazen swords and chitinous claws that tore meat from bones and left gouging wounds that would never heal. Kai had nothing to tell them, but still they demanded answers. Why, on a ship of innocence, had he been one of only two to survive? What gave him the right to live while they were condemned to eternal torment? Kai wept in his sleep, reliving the horror of their deaths over and over again. Only one voice was free of accusation, a soothing, cultured voice that spoke without words, but eased him from memories of pain with visions of a paradisiacal world of high mountains, verdant plains, and beautiful cities of glittering pyramids constructed from crystalline glass. When he woke, it was to find two people standing in his cell, a man and a woman, blandly attractive and dressed in crisp white tunics that had the look of lab coats and hazmat gear all in one. The man was the kind of handsome that comes from fashionable cosmetic sculpting, whereas the woman had lavished all her attention on her eyes. Pale emerald orbs, they were the most captivating eyes Kai had ever seen. "You're awake," said the man, needlessly, thought Kai. "It's time we found out what you know," added the woman. Kai rubbed his face, feeling the sagging skin of his jowls and a day's worth of stubble. "I told you I don't know anything," said Kai. "If I did, I promise I would tell you. I barely remember anything that happened in the Mind Hall." "Of course. We don't expect you to have any conscious recall of the information implanted in you by Anik Saroshina," said the woman, her expression plastic and unchanging. "But it is in you. That much is certain."
"It's our job to remove that information," said the man.
"Fine," said Kai. "Hook me up to a sidecaster and let's be done with it."
"Well, I'm afraid it won't be quite that simple," said the man.
"Or that painless," added the woman.
"Who are you?"
asked Kai. "You're not part of the City of Sight, so who do you work for?"
"My name is Adept Hiriko," said the woman, "and this is Adept Shaf. We are neurolocutors, psi augurs, if you will. That's augur with an E."
"As in a drill," added Shaf. "My role is to assist Adept Hiriko in boring into your psyche and rooting out whatever information has been secreted within your mind."
"Are you serious?"
"Quite serious," said Shaf, as though puzzled as to Kai's meaning.
"We are here at the behest of the Legio Custodes. Our orders come with the highest authority, giving us carte blanche to achieve our goals by any means necessary."
"I'm afraid it is likely you will not survive the process," said Hiriko. "But if you do, it is more than probable that you will be left in a permanent vegetative state."
"This is insane," cried Kai, backing away from these monsters.
"If you think about it clearly, it's really the only option open to us," said Shaf.
"We anticipated you would be reluctant to help us," added Hiriko. "How disappointing."
Kai could not speak. A gum shield that prevented him from biting off his tongue filled his mouth with a rubberized antiseptic taste. An air pipe plunged down his throat, and a leather headpiece studded with needles and electrodes enveloped his head like a pilot's helmet. A wealth of intravenous drips fed into his veins and the blood vessels beneath his skull, while a lidlock held his eyes open. Slender output jacks were plugged into the base of each orb, and bronze wires trailed to banks of ocular visual recording equipment. The interrogation chamber was horribly mundane. A simple metal box without windows or mirrors or anything in the way of character. Portable banks of monitoring equipment surrounded Kai as he lay back on a steel-framed gurney, each one telling a tale of his internal biorhythms. A humming device, like a gleaming scorpion's tail, was bolted to the metallic floor behind him, arcing overhead and festooned with dangling instruments that seemed designed to terrify as much as provide any function. Hiriko and Scharf busied themselves with monitoring the drugs flowing into his bloodstream, while the gold-armoured figure of Saturnalia stood at the far end of the chamber, his guardian spear held loosely in one hand.
"Are you ready to begin?" asked the custodian.
"Almost," replied Hiriko. "This is a delicate procedure, and one doesn't want to rush."
"The information you seek has been well hidden, custodian," added Scharf. "We will have to go deep into his psyche, and such a journey requires faultless preparation."
"We risk breaking his mind without due care and attention."
The custodian took a step towards the Psi augurs, his fingers clenching tightly on his guardian spear.
"The mistress of the Telepathica spoke of the Emperor," said Saturnalia, "and anything that concerns the Emperor is my business. Do not waste time in telling me of preparation and semantics. Find what she placed in his head and find it now. Breaking his mind is a price that concerns me not at all."
Kai wanted to rage at them, but his mouth couldn't form the words. He wanted to yell that he was a human being, an astropath of value to the Imperium. But he knew that even if he could make them hear, they would not care. Saturnalia, because his duty to the Emperor overrode all other concerns, Hiriko and Scharf, because they were simply doing a job. He tried to struggle, but the restraints and drugs held him utterly immobile. Hiriko sat beside him on a wheeled stool and consulted a data slate hanging from the side of the gurney.
"Excellent," she said. "You're making wonderful progress, Kai. We should be ready in just a moment."
Adept Scharf sat opposite Hiriko, and Kai saw him insert a screw plug into the back of his neck, where he could just see the gleam of implanted cognitive augmetics. He took the other end of the cable and plugged it into a featureless black box fitted to the side of the gurney. He smiled at Kai, unspooling a thin cable from the box and snap-fastening it to a connective port on Kai's leather headpiece. His eyes lost their focus for a second, and Kai felt a stab of pressure in the frontal lobes of his brain.
"Are you in the Umbra?" asked Hiriko.
"Yes," answered Scharf, his voice distant. "Ready for your insertion."
"Good," said Hiriko,
and likewise wired herself up to the featureless black box. She too fastened the end of a cable to the apparatus covering Kai's skull, and once again he felt the pressure of an invasive presence within his mind.
"Now," said Hiriko, "let us begin."
She depressed an orange stud on the side of the box, and Kai's mind filled with light. The light grew to unbearable brightness, like the surface of a star viewed so close that it would burn his eyes away. Kai screamed, and the light faded until it became tolerable. He found himself standing in the middle of the desert, nothing around him for hundreds of kilometers in all directions. A hot wind feathered the lips of dunes around him, and the hammer blows of the searing sun were a welcome relief after the sterile environment beneath the mountain. This was his place of safety. This was the empty quarter. Whatever they had done to him hadn't worked. Kai knew this wasn't real, knew it was an artificially conjured dreamscape, and in that realization he knew he should not have come here. This was what they wanted.
They wanted him here, where his innermost thoughts were laid bare and his deepest secrets might be revealed. Though he had professed a desire to tell Hiriko and Scharf what they wanted to know, an unbidden imperative arose in his mind that warned him against that path of least resistance. His life depended on keeping what he had been given secret. Only the man with the golden eyes could be told what he knew, and only by keeping it safe from Hiriko and Scharf would that be possible. No sooner had he given them names than he felt their presence in his mind. He couldn't see them, but he knew they were there, lurking, waiting for him to lead them to what they wanted to know. A figure appeared on the sand beside him, a robed woman with long silver-grey hair, with eyes that were kind and warm. He knew her, but not like this, not with eyes of flesh and blood. They were emerald green, sparkling and full of life. It seemed perverse to have willingly exchanged such beautiful eyes just to have gained protection from the creatures of the warp.
"Anik," he said, "you did."
"You should know better than that, Kai," said Sarashina. "No one is ever really dead, as so long as someone remembers them. As the great poet said, that which is imagined need never be lost."
"Sarashina told me that. But you're not Sarashina."
"No? Then who would you have me be?" said the woman, her features transforming in a heartbeat to those of his mother. Her eyes remained emerald green, but where before there was warmth, now there was only aching sadness. Kai turned away from those eyes, remembering the looks of sorrow every time he and his father had left on another adventure across the globe. He fought to remain dispassionate, but it was difficult in the face of the woman who had raised him and helped shape him into the man he had become. Except this wasn't her. His mother was dead, just as Sarashina was dead.
"You are Adept Hiriko, aren't you?"
"Of course," said his mother.
"Then look like you're supposed to," snapped Kai. "Don't hide behind disguises."
"I wasn't hiding," said Hiriko, assuming the form with which Kai was more familiar. "I am simply trying to put you at your ease. This process will go much smoother if you don't fight us. I know you don't know what Sarashina told you, but I need to find it."
"I don't know where it is."
"I think you do."
"I don't."
Hiriko sighed and linked her arm with his, guiding him towards the gentle slope of a sand dune. "Do you know how many psychic interrogations I've done?" "No, of course you don't. But it's a lot, and the subjects who fight us are always the ones who end up brain dead. Do you want that?"
"What kind of stupid question is that?"
She shrugged and continued as though he hadn't spoken. "The human mind is a dizzyingly complex machine, a repository of billions of memories, inputs, outputs, and autonomic functions. It's hard to break into it without causing irreparable damage."
"So don't break in," said Kai.
"I wish that were possible. I truly do," said Hiriko with a smile. "I like you. But I will tear the meat of your mind apart with my bare hands if I have to. Everyone yields their secrets in the end. Always. It's just a matter of how much damage they're prepared to live with at the end of it." They reached the top of the sand dune, and Kai found himself looking down at the shimmering fortress of Azeshkun. Its tallest towers wavered in the heat, and Kai shielded his eyes against the reflected glare of sunlight from its golden minarets.
"Impressive," said Hiriko. "But it won't keep me out. Don't think for a minute it will."
Kai stopped and turned about, scanning the sands for some sign that they weren't alone. A suggestion of shadow moving under the sand on a far distant dune flickered at the corner of his vision.
"Where is Scharf?" he asked. "Doesn't he join you?"
"He's here, but I'm leading this auger."
Intuition surfaced in Kai's mind like a sunrise, and a slow smile creased his features.
Well, he's here to pull you out if this gets too dangerous, isn't he?
A flash of irritation in her emerald eyes confirmed his insight.
You don't know if you can do this, do you?
He said. Hariko's grip on his arm tightened.
Trust me, I can do this. The only question is how hard you want it to go. I'll demolish that fortress in a heartbeat. Tear down every fictive stone and brick. I'll break it down to dust and powder until you won't be able to tell its remains from the sand of the desert.
She stretched out her hand, and the tallest tower of the fortress began unravelling. What had seemed solid only moments before was now dissolving into smoke and vapour. She clicked her fingers and another tower fell apart. Hariko met his gaze as she undid in a heartbeat what had taken him years to perfect. But his eyes were on something far distant, something fashioned from dark memory and horror. It pushed through the sands towards them, the predator with the scent of blood in its nostrils. Kai felt a spike of pressure behind his eyes, and Hariko turned in time to see the dark shape power to the surface of the sand. It came on a tide of blood, a subterranean river violently thrust to the surface of the desert. It roared, this river. It roared and screamed and filled the world with thousands of death cries and agonizing last moments. Like a deluge of crimson oil, it spilled over the desert, filling the depressions between the dunes with pools of stinking death fluids, washing up their slopes like an angry tide.
"Is this your doing?" demanded Hariko.
"No,"
said Kai.
"Stop it,"
ordered Hariko.
"Now!" "I can't." "Of course you can. This is your mind. It bends to your will."
Kai shrugged as the swelling lake of oily blood rose higher, its surface rippling with the motion of thousands of hands and faces pushing up from below. Until now, Kai had always feared this buried monster, its rages and its guilt. But now the sight of it was a blessed relief. The oozing tide rolled uphill in defiance of hydrodynamics, and gelatinous shapes at last broke the surface of its stinking substance. Tall and thin, with spindly limbs of red scale and volcanic breath, they folded themselves into existence with thin, screeching wails. Their distended skulls formed glossy and horned, their mouths ripped open with jagged fangs. Creatures of memory, to be sure, but no less dangerous for that in a place of dreams.
"What are you doing?"
demanded Hariko.
"I told you, it's not me,"
said Kai.
"It's the Argo."
The tide of night-skinned monsters roiled towards them, and Hariko looked up to the sky.
"Get me out of here," she said. "Now."
The adept vanished, and the tide of darkness that billowed and seethed like a living curtain of endless darkness spilled over the top of the dune, swallowing Kai and plunging him into an abyss from which there could be no escape.
"What's just happened?"
demanded Saturnalia. Hariko lay on the floor of the interrogation room, her eyes rolling back in their sockets and blood running from her nose like a tap. Scharf propped up her head and administered a hypo of clear fluid via a cannula on her forearm.
"I asked you a question,"
said Saturnalia.
"Be silent,"
said Scharf. "I just extracted her from a hostile dream space without any of the prescribed decompressions. Her mind has gone into shock, and if I don't bring her back, we might lose her completely." Saturnalia bristled with anger at being spoken to like a subordinate, but bit back his anger. Consequences for speaking out of turn to a warrior of the Legio Custodes could wait.
"What can I do?"
he said.
"Nothing,"
said Scharf.
"It's up to her now."
Scharf continued to speak to Hariko in low, soothing tones, stroking her cheek and holding her hand. Eventually, her eyes fluttered open and gained a clarity Saturnalia hadn't been sure she would ever know again.
"This is going to be harder than I thought," said Hariko.